The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
You found it. You're here. You are headlong down the runaway train that is the Anomic Age, and I am your host, John H. Thanks for being with us today on the program. I'm real excited to talk to Mr. John Waters today, coming to us from Ireland, all the way across the pond. He'll be speaking with us today. So it's a great show. We got a great deal of information to get into. Check out AnomicAge.com. If you've not already done so, I can't imagine why. Now is the time. All the social media links there are at the top, or at least those of the social media link variety that I'm still a part of. So we got BitChute, we got Brighteam, still on YouTube, surprisingly, and shockingly still on Facebook as well. There's a few more, but those are the main ones at the top there. So you can sign up for the subscriptions. You can like all the likes and so forth from the social media accounts. But to be honest, they're all secondary bollocks. What really matters is AnomicAge.com. That's going to be the masthead that I sincerely hope will be here long after the social media monopolies are gone. I'll say with the exclusion of Brighteon. I don't think they're going anywhere, or at least I don't think they're going to cave and go anywhere. I hope they don't get taken down, but I wouldn't doubt it. But nevertheless, AnomicAge.com is the place where you can find all things me, all things Anomic Age, all the guests, all the video, all the audio. You can sign up for the newsletter, which will be increasingly important as we fall deeper into despotism. You can assuredly download the iPhone, the Android app. You can check it out directly from iTunes there as well. But, as I say, the most important thing for me, if you like the show, you love the guests, you want to keep this whole thing afloat, paypal.me/AnomicAge, patreon.com/AnomicAge as well. If you missed all that, if you're just now tuning in, just go to AnomicAge.com. You can find everything you need from me there, including today's episode with this fantastic guest. So hold on to your hats. Strap yourself in. Great show with Mr. John Waters. Coming to you in just a mere matter of seconds. Stick around. It's my pleasure today to welcome Mr. John Waters into the Anomic Age. John started his career in 1981 with the Irish music journal Hot Press. He later wrote in the Irish Times from 1990 until 2014. His first book, Jiving at the Crossroads, about the cultural underbelly of Irish politics at the height of the Haughty era, became a massive bestseller. He went on to write and publish 8 other books, including An Intelligent Person's Guide to Modern Ireland and Was It for This? Why Ireland Lost the Plot. He's also a permanent research fellow at the Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. Thank you so much, John, for being on the program. It's an honor, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here, John. Nice to be with you.
Indeed. Well, I guess we got to start at the beginning to a certain degree with all this COVID nonsense. I know you had an appeal last week, but I got to be honest with you. Here in America, I think the Americans are so caught up in the total insanity that's going on here. We're kind of neglecting what's really going on globally. And especially with all the censorship, we see Parler down. I used to follow a lot of your work and Mrs. O'Doherty's work on Parler, but now I can't even do that. So we're kind of reliant, sadly, on sites like the Irish Times and the like to sort of tell us what's going on over there.
Well, then I'm sorry to say you've got...
I know, we're really in a bad spot, so I'm so happy you're here.
You're in big trouble if you're dependent on the Irish Times. I wrote for them for many years, but it's a completely corrupted newspaper now, I'm afraid. It just says lies and lies and lies. It's very interesting, you know, you say that about the COVID thing. I've been watching from the other direction and looking at America. There's something I find very odd about the American thing. I can't quite figure it out. Maybe you can help me. Because, you know, I got into this COVID thing about in March last year when it started here. And I was kind of convinced by the idea of the virus and of this pandemic and all that. Because I'd been ill twice in the previous 24 months, pretty seriously ill with cancer and with another thing, which was really like almost like a viral stroke that wiped out half my face and maybe I'm deaf in my left ear, stuff like that. So I was kind of, I felt that my immune system was going to be pretty low. So I've been very careful. And then gradually I kind of came to see this for what I believe it is, a scam, a really sinister, dark scam. And you know, that's been the situation. I mean, obviously, there's a big divide. I mean, very small number of people see through it. A lot of people are taken in by it here. That's the general pattern, not just here, but in Britain and across Europe generally. But America seems to be very strange on it, because even though there's been a lot of protests and people standing up to the tyranny that's unfolded there in some states, there doesn't seem to be any real consciousness that it's actually somehow directed at an entirely different purpose than public health or any kind of health. That it's, there's actually an undercurrent with to do with the, we now understand, the New World Order, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, the Great Reset, Klaus Schwab and these guys, and that these big tech oligarchs are up to their necks in it. And that it's actually fundamentally, I would say, very much what Donald Trump was about, which was like defending the working people of America, and I would extend that the working people of the world, against a final onslaught on their right to be and their right to live. You know, it seems to me that it's something like, you know, if people go back a century to the early part of the 20th century, the first year, there was this, the last big revolution, or the last big revolution, which, as it were, looted the skills and knowledge of the working people and transferred it onto machines. That was like under the guidance of Frederick Taylor, who was involved with Henry Ford. Like in 1908, virtually every car that the Ford Corporation constructed was built by hand, by really top-class craftsmen. Like they were like, you know, upholsterers and painters and wheel builders and you just name it. They, you know, and within about 5 years, they had created the production line, and they had essentially taken all those skills, you know, inputted them, however, into the machines, and they were basically the people who had developed these skills and who held these skills as their very life force almost were abandoned. And I think this is a similar moment, except it's much, much worse. It's much more general. It's actually taking, it's directed at taking everything and importing it into computers and discarding essentially the part of the human race which for up to now has made and mended the world every day, who has made things with their hands, with their minds, and has, you know, really sustained the world. And they're now being told, we don't need you anymore. We're just going to steal the last vestiges of your creativity, of your, you know, craftsmanship, of your trades, of your skills, and then we're going to dump you on the scrap heap. And we're going to throw you a few dollars every week just to keep you from dying. But just keep your mouth shut, okay? That's the deal. That's what's been offered. And to me, that was always what Donald Trump was about.
Yeah.
This revolution, that the Trump revolution, which seems to be in suspension now. I'm not so sure that it's over, but I think it's in suspension. And the COVID thing, it seemed to me, was an accelerant, was the crucial moment. And the strange, this is my point, really, that what was really baffled me was that Trump didn't seem to see what the COVID thing was. And nor did a lot of the people that I would really respect in America, who were kind of like the great intellectuals. I think of someone like, say, Victor Davis Hanson, you know, because when he would talk about it, he would talk really intelligently about Trump and what Trump was about and why Trump was so important. But when he talked about COVID, he kind of like almost like genuflected before the god COVID, just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. And this is something I just don't get, because that doesn't happen here in Europe. You either get the whole thing or you get nothing. You know, there isn't a kind of a middle ground where people, you know, are, you know, as it were, conservative or, you know, whatever you, I don't know, like, I don't know if those are very useful words anymore, to be honest, but that people, if they understand generally what's been happening in the world, they instantly get the COVID scam for what it is. And in America, that generally speaking doesn't happen. Not now, it's not, that isn't a, that's not a universal analysis. There are people who obviously get it. But that, it just baffles me somewhat, you know?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that was the blind spot of Trump, or perhaps that was him trying to placate the masses that actually believed in that stuff, because I was just totally off put by the debates a few months ago because he wasn't just coming out and saying this is a scam. He was still sort of placating the mentally ill that believed in this mess and say, oh, well, we got this vaccine and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, man, the first debate you should have come out and said, this is a hoax, folks. We're going back to work.
Yeah.
If Biden and his regime want to do that mess, fine. We're going back to work. Let's open the cities. Let's open the businesses and so forth, because the American people and people in general just need to get back to their lives. This is total insanity, right?
It's total insanity, yeah. I think that's probably it. I think he lost his nerve at that moment because they did come after him, you know, at the very beginning, big time. And, of course, the media, you know, the legacy media were really against him on all that. And they were trying to set him up as being like this great kind of incompetent ogre who had destroyed the American people through a virus. That was completely transparent. But he seemed to buy into the risk that was there, that if it really blew up, he could be caught out. And so he went, seemed to go along with it all the way. But even now, even the day, I remember seeing him out in Texas at the Alamo, and he made a speech, and he was still talking about, you know, how that the virus in Mexico is really bad, but this side of the wall, there was nothing, you know. What's he playing at? You know, what? Surely he knows by now, and he's nothing to lose by saying, by the way, one last thing, this was a complete scam.
Yeah.
And Fauci should be in jail. You know, that's I kind of wanted that to happen, but it hasn't happened. So I don't know. But maybe he's got a cunning plan. We hope so.
I hope so. I'm not sure if he really underestimated his base in thinking that he had to play along with this nonsense, but I think he would have gained way more credibility had he just come out from the get-go, and or at least once he figured this out, you know, a couple weeks into it, hey, this is a hoax. Let's just get back to work.
Yeah,
I think he would have gained much more credibility.
Yeah, I think he was scared by the kind of New York phenomenon because nobody could really analyze that. But I mean, I think, you know, that's kind of explicable in various ways. I mean, maybe you have a different understanding of it, but it seems to me that, you know, people's health in New York isn't great, but a lot of people would have respiratory conditions and so on. But more than that, it seems to me obvious that the whole thing was almost set up. We had this there's a brilliant scientist in Canada called Dennis Rancourt, or Dini Rancourt, and he's written a series of papers about this. And one of them is like really quite sensational, because what he actually says is there was no plague. There was mass homicide by government policy. Now, that's a really, and he shows it. He did demonstrate it with charts, and he just talks about the COVID peak. This, if you've noticed, like when you actually look at a lot of places, not everywhere, but almost a hell of a lot of places, there's this extraordinary spike that has never before happened in this kind of epidemiology. You never see it. You'll see charts, they're like mountain ranges, but suddenly you have like this kind of peak that's almost unnatural. And he actually reckons that actually occurred because of panic and stress in nursing homes in basically the end of second half of March, April, and the beginning of May. And when you look at the charts, you can see that totally borne out in the charts. So I think that, you know, that was scaring people. And I think it may have scared Trump because there wasn't a ready explanation for that. But what it means is that the politicians in those places are culpable because of they allowed this panic to happen, and the media are culpable. And I really believe, John, you know, that I said last night here in Ireland, we have a national TV station called RTE, which has been lying like on a 24/7 basis since this started. And I was comparing this like to kind of like almost like a situation of mass murder, and saying that when this is over, if it ever is over, that what needs to happen is that the buildings of these media organizations need to be razed to the ground. And on the sites, there should be shrines or parks dedicated to the people who died unnecessarily in this, in order to provide bodies for the propaganda being promoted by these guys. And I believe also, John, that even though this has been a long-running plan, we know a great deal. There are people who tell you, I'm not an expert in it, but they tell you, this goes back centuries. This has been planned for centuries as a way of enslaving the world. But I think that the timing of it certainly seemed to be directed at one thing, and that was at removing Donald Trump. Because he, at this moment, represents the real impediment to the agenda. Because he intuitively understood what they were doing. I don't mean the COVID thing, but in the overall sense, he got it, that the people that supported him were being, you know, sidelined for marginalization, for obsolescence. And that that's why I was so puzzled that he didn't put the whole thing together completely. But as you say, there may be these other explanations that he just didn't have the nerve. It was a big risk, obviously, if things really blew up, and if he was wrong, he would be completely finished. So he was kind of hedging his bets, I think. And that didn't really work out so well. Not that it was connected to what happened in the election, obviously, because that was just a straight theft of the election. But I think it probably did muddy things a little bit. And it's a pity, you know, I mean, for the world, not just for America, it's a great pity. I think anybody who knows what's been happening and the last period knows that, you know, Donald Trump was the last. I have an article on my website. My website is called John Waters Unchained. And I wrote a number of articles about Trump over the period of the election, before and during and after. And the last one was called Après Trump le Déluge. And that's what I really believe, not just for America, but for the world, that you can see the insanity and the filth that's pouring out of the, I don't know if Biden has allowed him to the White House. There's a rumor he's not, that he's in some kind of film set somewhere. I don't know. Who knows? But whatever, that there's this effluent is now pouring out of his government or quasi-government. And it's pouring all over the world, not just over America.
Yeah, I think they are just so afraid of everything that he represented, because if you look back at past presidents, sure, they had this great power, and yes, they had, I suppose, a global effect, because, you know, across the pond in South America and Africa and so forth, everyone recognized that person or what have you, but they really feared, I think, the cultural phenomenon of what Trump represented, because he really transcended the right-left paradigm, the Democrat-Republican bollocks that we have going on here. I mean, he was really so influential, I think, in people in Europe and, of course, South America and even Mexico to an extent, because it was such a cultural phenomenon. And it caused, I think, a lot of people across the globe to sort of stand up and say, wait a minute, we're not crazy. We're not alone. And it really challenged that global hegemonic power that the globalists have relied on for so long.
It's very interesting, you know. Trump for me is a mythological figure. You know, he's like one of those rare figures that comes like once every couple of centuries. Like he's like that rare, you know. Like he's a Caesar, he's a Napoleon, you know, in a different way. But it's that kind of, and I think, you know, it's very interesting. Victor Davis Hanson, who I mentioned already, is like a brilliant, brilliant guy, a classical scholar, but also a movie buff, a great fan of movies, particularly Westerns. And he's this kind of thing. He talks about Trump as this kind of like Shane figure who comes into town to do the dirty job. You know, he's got to clean up the town, but he has to do it in slightly irregular ways. And he plays with the lines and the law a little bit. And in the end, the townspeople, they really want to see the back of him, you know. Once he's cleaned up the town, once he's done the job, they want him to leave. That's what Victor Davis Hanson was saying. And I think there's something in that. But what astonished me about Victor Davis Hanson's analysis of Trump, that he missed in completely the perfect analogy, the perfect movie analogy for Trump. And that is the movie from the 70s, I think 75, called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, where R.P. McMurphy goes into the mental asylum and he sees all these guys, many of whom actually are locked up, but are actually voluntarily locked up, and their spirits are broken. And there's this tyrant, Nurse Ratched. And it's very interesting, the medical thing here as well, you know, the medical, like, Nurse Ratched. And he confronts her very subtly and very, you know, but he's this rebel. And this is the story of Trump, you know, that he actually said, you can, and Clinton, like, look, actually looks like Nurse Ratched. Hillary Clinton,
look,
you know, and Trump actually confronted this and said to people, you can beat this if you just stand up. You know, we can beat it together. And they did beat it. Unlike the movie, like, where Mike Murphy, you know, well, I mean, I don't want to spoil the movie for people, but, you know, Mike Murphy doesn't make it to the end.
Yeah.
But it's still a heroic ending. It's still a liberation in the end. And of course, Trump is a liberation in the end as well, despite what happened. And I don't think the story is finished. I think there's kind of maybe a bad chapter before the end and then the good chapter at the end to come. I hope so anyway, because this isn't just about Trump. The astonishing thing about Trump was, you know, that somebody could be so good and so smart and acquire reputations completely to the contrary because of the corruption of the media that they sold. I mean, in Ireland, if you try to defend Trump in Ireland, you're going to be spat in the face, you know, because people are just so thick about this. You just can't see the man. And I said to people back in 2016, you know, when the darkness comes, it will not look like Donald Trump. It'll be suave and polished and sophisticated in a certain way that Trump isn't, but actually is in another way. I mean, he is a very sophisticated man, but he just doesn't play that. I think it's the most amazing story, you know, and I think that I hope it's not over, but I don't think it is over, you know, John.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that sort of media bias, because I was preparing for this last night and looking up some things online, and I actually say this on the screen because I typed in violence in Europe, and the first several headlines you get are far right leaders in Europe still supporting Trump and blah, 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 blah. Basically just sort of trying to pigeonhole and group everyone together, saying all these extremists are somehow connected to Trump and connected to conservatives.
But John, you know,
this is
amazing, you know, when you think of this brass neck, they say it's like, you know, these guys use faith. They use phrases like far right, you know, about people who are actually salt of the earth, common sense, decent people, right? We're trying to restore decent values, you know, fairness, justice, truth to their societies, right? You know, and they call them fascism. The fascists, actually, quite self-evidently, are the other side. There is the Democrat Party in the United States. It's the, you know, the people who are imposing COVID laws, you know, talking to people about detention centers for being sick. Like, imagine. I mean, we have our deputy prime minister last night actually on TV talking of musing, like, about, you know, if they had to close the airport and, you know, the detention centres, you know, and the kind of security vans it would have. And I was saying, you know, if you actually were to type out everything he wrote, okay, on a piece of paper and show it to people and say, okay, I want to ask you a question. This is Leah. This statement was made by either A, Leo Varadkar, which is the guy I'm talking about. He's the deputy prime minister, the Taoiseach that we call that. It's either Leo Varadkar or B, Adolf Eichmann, talking about the transportation of Jews to Auschwitz, right? Mm-hmm. Which is it? Everybody would think, oh, it's Eichmann for sure. It's got to be Eichmann. And they can't see it. And they're calling Trump a fascist and a far right and a Nazi and all this stuff. You don't have to look anywhere. You know, they're pointing, but it's the old cliche. There are four fingers pointing back at themselves and they don't see them. You know, like, it's absolutely insane. We actually have fascism now in Europe and America.
Yep.
But it ain't Donald Trump and it ain't Matteo Salvini. You know, it's these guys, and it's got to be, you've got to say, it's people like Boris Johnson in England, in the United Kingdom, who's gone, like, completely crazy. Like, he was a guy who looked like a half-decent guy. Gone. And, you see these appalling monsters like who are coming out, the governors of some of the American states and the Prime Minister of New Zealand and Canada, my God, Canada and Australia. You see these fascistic police forces, these kind of robocops, you know, beating the heads off decent, ordinary people, working people. And they're the same people that are doing this. They're calling other people fascists. My God, it's post-irony, you know?
It's so unbelievable. Because I was covering this on my show several weeks ago where I was looking at the parallels between communism in the past and what we're seeing today. And I was looking at 1933 Russia, where they started doing these internal passports and they had already put people in gulags and they were forcing folks into starvation. And I was paralleling that to what we're seeing here in the U.S. And sadly, I look at most of Europe and Australia and other countries as sort of a barometer of what we're going to see here, because we're already seeing those draconian measures put in place in Australia and Canada and so forth. And I say, hey, America, we're seeing that, and we're going to see it here domestically in a matter of weeks, most likely.
Well, I mean, it certainly looks like the Biden administration is going to kind of roll out a very tyrannical program now with masks and all kinds of restrictions, even maybe even curfews. Who knows? We have curfews now in Europe in some places, which they haven't had since World War II, you know. And this is for the flu, I keep telling people. This is for the flu, because that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's what it is. It's the flu. And they, for this pretext, they have managed. Because fundamentally, John, you see, I used to be, as you said there, I was a journalist. I'm not really a journalist anymore. I am ashamed to say that I was ever a journalist now, because it's such a shameful profession. But, I mean, none of this would be possible had the media not been completely corrupted. And it's a very interesting story as to why it was corrupted. What happened, you know? Because even like I would say 20 years ago, the media, you know, everybody complained about the media to some extent always, but there was always kind of marginal stuff, you know? You know, tabloidism or, you know, sensationalism or, you know, yeah, there would be lies obviously here and there. But by and large, most journalists were trying to tell the truth on a daily basis. And what happened was then the media or the internet came in. And they made a media made a tactical error, big tactical error, where they decided that they were kind of trying to join this new interloper, and they went online and they basically started giving their product away, which meant that they fed their enemy. They fed the people who were about to destroy them, the Googles and the Facebooks, who then now had a product which was hard won by journalists going out, you know, wearing out their shoe leather, you know, finding things out. And they were suddenly giving it away instead of, you know, continuing that relationship with their readers, whereby the reader seeing what was being done for, on his behalf was willing to pay for it, a small stipend every day or whatever number of days a week he bought a newspaper to pay for this for the protection of democracy that it represented, right? That really was the deal. And the fourth estate. And, so they give it to the big techs, who are completely like immoral people. You know, I mean, these organizations, they're completely without morality or without conscience. And the next, they started to swallow it up, and then they started to swallow up the media. So then when it came to this moment where, you know, you had this long running plan to basically enslave the world, and Donald Trump was standing in the way, but this, the timing of it was to take him out in 2020. Coincidentally, or whatever, the media was in this odd situation where it was on the way out. The legacy media, I mean, were on the way out. They were nearly bunched. They were nearly screwed, but not quite. They still had a residual audience. And ironically, or felicitously, or infelicitously, maybe, their audience was mainly old people, older people, mm-hmm. who, as it happened, would be the most vulnerable to this new so-called virus, COVID-19, or SARS-CoV-2 is the virus. COVID-19 is the disease, so-called. And so they were able to actually weaponize that last gasp of the dying media against their own readers and deliver this thing so they had something to sell again. But they were selling this time now not to their readers for the dollars, couple of dollars or euros, every day, they were selling it to the governments and the health czars and the big pharma companies who were prepared to subsidize them to do this dirty job for them. And that's essentially what's happened. Because without the propaganda, the, as I call them, the walls of lies that media were able to build up around every person virtually, except somebody who had managed to liberate themselves through knowledge. And they've convinced them that there was something terrible that could kill them at any moment. Without that, none of this would have worked. It would have been over in a few days. But it's gone on now for nearly a year. And we're digging deeper and deeper into it. And I saw a thing that people will be staggered by this. I was quite staggered by it because at a certain point you keep hoping that it's going to stop, you know?
Yeah.
But somebody drew my attention to a page on the World Bank website, which talks about the COVID project. And it has two dates, right? And the start date is, well, it's uncontroversial. March, this is in America, Europe, March 2020. That's the start date it puts down for the COVID project. Do you know what the finish date is?
No.
March 2025.
Wow.
Exactly.
What is their end game in this project? What are they saying that's going to be, the finished product's going to look like? Just global tyranny?
They don't describe it, you know, but I think what we know is that it will actually have destroyed pretty much all the normative expectations of the population of the Western world. In terms of their right of movement, their right to travel, their right to earn a livelihood, their capacity to earn a livelihood, their right to have private property, their own income will no longer be, it'll be public knowledge. They will be, you know, there will be no cash, so you won't be able to have a private, not just will you not be allowed to have private exchanges, but they will be able to turn your money on and off if you misbehave. So we will have a kind of a Chinese social credit system, which will be watching everybody. Big data will be watching. This is beyond Orwell. I mean, Orwell talked about Big Brother and the telescreen and the corner. All that and more is going to happen. It's already happening. And essentially what this is about, therefore, is, as I say, plundering the last vestiges of creativity and skill from the human person and then discarding them. Except that they will still be harnessed up to biometric systems to harvest their energies, their bioenergy and their psychic energy and their mental energy to drive, as it were, what I call the combine. Actually, it's a word from once over the cook's mess as well. I mean, Chief Bromden, who is the central figure in the book, not in the movie, Nicholson's character, McMurphy, was central in the book. But Chief Bromden used to talk about the Combine, which is this kind of tyrannical syndicate that ran the world. And we're really there now. We're really there with big tech and big pharma and then the hidden puppet masters that we hear about, what used to be called the Illuminati. But, you know, we've seen them above ground in things like the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderbergers, the Davos, what Stephen Bannon calls the Party of Davos. You know, that's kind of what's running the world now and will be running the world unless Trump resurrects real fast. Maybe Easter Sunday is a good time to think about resurrecting and comes back to save the world.
Well, I think they're uncloaking. I mean, everything you said is just so spot on with all these various groups, Davos, Bilderberg, Trilateral Commission, Council on Foreign Relations, all of them have basically gotten behind that same mantra. And I mean, historically, it's just the eugenics mantra where they just want to do away with the huge swath of the population. And it's a global population. It's not just picking on Ireland or Canada or Australia. I mean, they want us all pretty much gone. And they've sort of gotten the carrot in front of the donkey, if you will, and sort of guiding everybody through this under the guise of, well, you won't have to work as much because there'll be all this mechanization and so forth. But they're not telling everybody what all that mechanization really means. It really just means no more humans. It's Brave New World. It's 1984, but it's also all the technocratic elite and what they've talked about for centuries. They just want to do away with humans. But people are just thinking, oh, well, I'll just get to go through a checkout line and not talk to anybody. But I think they're failing to grasp the psychology of that, and that humans are social creatures. And that's one of the aspects of this stupid mask mess, is that they've done away with people's ability to communicate and to be human. And well, once you do that, you know, you're not having that exchange with the mechanic at the garage or with the checkout girl or all this stuff. I mean, that's what, in essence, makes us us.
Well, exactly, John. I mean, you know, when you actually think about these mechanisms, which are, you know, camouflaged as measures to protect people's health, but they also actually, and much more obviously when you reflect on them for a moment or two, they separate people. You know, they stop people talking to one another. You know, the kind of place, like in Ireland, like the pub was always a kind of a place of kind of subversion, you know, minor subversion maybe most of the time. But, you know, people go and they start to compare notes, and people who are not persuaded of something become persuaded in the pub by argument and by you know, rhetoric. That's the culture, you know, of its essence. But when you think about that, they've actually, you know, not just stopped people, they've closed the pubs, but they make people stand 6 foot apart when they're speaking now in public. And just think of the mask as well. I mean, it's an amazing thing. It stops you seeing all of the moving parts of the face, pretty much, apart from the blink of the eye, are gone. The thing that tell you, you know, the demeanor of the person towards you, you know, if somebody is smiling, if they're frowning, if they're scowling, you know. Now that's gone. They're just kind of some kind of like a turnip head, you know?
Yeah, and, those subtle cues are gone.
Yeah, and so we're more reticent. And I've noticed, I don't know about you, John, but like I've noticed that there's kind of like people are on a very short fuse now. Like I have a daughter, and she got into an altercation down in the country. She called me in quite distressed today, you know, because she'd been in an altercation on a beach with somebody who their dogs, she was walking her dog and the other person had a dog. And the dog started trying to get too friendly, or, you know, started barking or whatever. And this guy went crazy and started hanging around, following her and threatening her and all this. And she had to call the cops in the end, you know. And this is, I said to her, this is what they've done to the human race for the last 10 months, you know. This is part of it. It's to drive people to the edge so that they're going to hate each other. And you know, like the very idea of the mask, you actually think about this. What does it do? Well, what it does is send a signal one person to the other, which is that the other person represents a danger to my health. The other person is a festering mess of viruses, pathogens, you know, dangerous bugs, which is really unclean and threatens my life. And you can see people jumping out of the off the footpath into under a bus almost, you know, to escape, you know, proximity to another human being. This is beyond evil. This is a new kind of evil that they've managed to achieve in this. And people still think it's about health. It's the last thing it's about. This is about destroying I just say to people, you think it's about health. Have you seen the pictures from Europe of the police with batons beating the heads of protesters? Peaceful protesters on horseback, police on horseback, beating, swinging their clubs at these people. And you think that's about your health? They care about your health? You know, are you crazy? I despair. You see, one of the things, you know, I had a friend once in Kiev. He's a philosopher. He's an elderly man now. I mean, I'm getting there myself, but he was maybe 25 years older than me. And he was an industrial philosopher. He invented computer systems way back. I'm talking in the 70s. Like he was in the earliest waves of the computer revolution. And he used to work in Japan quite a lot. He designed systems for Japan. And he had an obsession that we were going down the wrong road with the kind of computer systems we were designing, which were binary and which were trying to, would end up, he said, stealing the creativity of the human person rather than complementing it. And he thought there was an alternative. I didn't really understand. His name was Mike Cooley, and if people want to check him out, he wrote an amazing book called Architect or Be. You should be able to get it. Don't get it on Amazon. Don't get anything on Amazon, but get it somewhere. You can buy it off a bookshop, maybe online.
What's his name one more time?
Mike Cooley, Cooley. And he was a really brilliant guy. He still is around. He lives in England, in Slough, in England, I believe. I haven't seen him for quite a few years, and we haven't been in touch. But he used to say, you know, that he didn't think that it was possible to invent a machine that was smarter than a human person. He thought that, you know, that, and that seems to make sense in a way, you know, because I understand that idea. I understand that idea in the sense that, well, if a human person is inventing these, surely the human who invents them is smarter than what he invents by definition. At the very most, he's going to invent something just as smart as himself. But when you actually think of the analogy of data, that falls apart, first of all. Because, you know, you don't know as much about yourself as Mark Zuckerberg can find out by tapping a few buttons. That's really true. None of us do. We don't understand how he can put together not just the data he has harvested from me or you, but all the data he has harvested from all the people who know you or me, and who know people who know you or me, and who know the people who know you, people who know you or me. And he can actually do that and create an algorithm that brings all that together and makes predictive assumptions about what you would do in any given situation. Situations that you've never been in. But he can tell you, probably within a margin of error less than 1%, what you would do in any of those situations. Just think about that. So it's not, that's the first thing. But I used to say to Mike, you know, I says, you know, jokingly, because this is his area. He was a brilliant guy. And I used to say, yeah, but Mike, you know, what if, first of all, they make the human being stupid? What then? Then do you think they can make a machine smarter? And that's already happened. And I think the greatest criminal or the greatest culprit in that process has been television. Television has, I don't know about you, but I've noticed it in Ireland very, very, very dramatically. Because when we were kids, I mean, we didn't have television in our house. And I used to go to neighbors' houses sometimes and see programs. And it was just one channel. But it was like, okay, there'd be comedy and there'd be sort of, you know, Hawaii 5-0 would be on, you know, Ironside and stuff like that. We used to love that kind of stuff, you know, and the Rockford Files. But then there would be like a serious documentary. And there would be a current affairs program with a very serious discussion. And then there'd be a poetry program, a literary program, or a music program. So it was like little sections of, and it was really like an adjunct. It was a bit like what Mike's talking about. Mike was talking about that it was actually a complement of the human creativity and intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. But at some point in the last 30 years, it seemed to flip over. And it started sucking the creativity and the originality and the intelligence out of the person. And if you look now, I don't watch TV, but it seems to be aimed at some kind of really stupid person who is a little bit below the stupidest person you ever met. You know?
That's the truth. Well, I think all this is by design. I mean, to touch on what you just said, I think that's absolutely what's going on. And I think to a certain degree, they know that folks will watch a show and identify, if not outright emulate, much like a child might, they're gonna do the same thing as an adult to a certain degree, whatever they see. So they know they're gonna push the most just lowbrow idiocy, and the, you know, average person will subtly begin to change that part of themselves and start acting just that stupid. And they're watching more, and it's lowering their brain waves. And all the while that's going on, they're pushing subtly these propaganda bits in about destruction of the family, about feminization of males, about X, Y, and Z, and here we are. Yeah. I think all that's so by design, like a directed weapon.
Well, exactly. That's exactly the thing, you know, this propaganda. I was actually talking about this only last night to Gemma on her stream. Because I've studied that quite a lot in recent years, because we had these kind of attacks on our constitution in referendums, you know, to get rid of marriage as it was, and bring in abortion and all this stuff, and they really pumped huge amounts of money into Ireland to change these things and to destroy our constitution and to destroy the meaning of parenting, of the meaning of marriage, the meaning of family, you know, the meaning of the protection of life. All those things are now gone from our constitution because of this. And so I was studying about it, and I went back to it. When you actually see, like, you know, like the last 100 years has been really the heyday of propaganda, starting back in the 30s with Bernays, who was this grand nephew of Sigmund Freud, who used a lot of Freud's ideas and put them into a kind of media context. And then you had other people who had analyzed that, you know, from a more critical. He, like Bernays, was very much into building, helping, working with the industries, the advertising industry in particular. And then you had people, Vance Packard wrote a book back in the 50s about, you know, the hidden persuaders, about how these guys actually worked and how they manipulated people and how they figured out what people really meant, what their real intentions were, as opposed to what they were telling the pollsters, the you know, and all that. And they really developed a lot of subtlety in that. But if you actually think about it, at that time, like in say the first half to the middle of the 20th century, all there was like newspapers, radio, and, you know, public hoardings. Like, there was a little bit of TV, but not so much. Now we have total saturation TV. We have internet. We have social media. All of us are being assailed 24/7 by this pummeling of propaganda. So that, in a sense, we're a different person. We're a different species now, mentally.
Yeah. Well, they've shown it rewires the brain. It's all this technology on iPhones and pads. It's rewiring the younger generation's brains.
It is. And what is astonishing about it is that there, I mean, obviously there's some commentary around this, but it doesn't seem to kind of really get it that actually that the principles were, that were established by these guys like Bernays and Lull and these guys, Jackie Lull, in the early part of the 20th century need to be updated seriously, if not completely thrown out or at least modified radically to understand what kind of person, the human person, the average human person is now in this culture. Because it seems to me that what's actually happened is something like that our brains have been vacated of all independent capacity for thought and have been left like empty shells which are filled on a moment-to-moment basis. It's like a bucket with a hole in it, you know? Mm-hmm. Just the water keeps pouring in, but it keeps pouring out as well. And such a brain is so susceptible to suggestion and to emotional manipulation. I mean, I think we actually have now in our culture the capacity to, in effect, impose a hypnotic trance on entire populations through the use of media and the use of devices like terror, like terrorizing people, you know, with human interest stories, which seem to be kind of like, you know, the death is coming, death is coming. And I think that we, therefore, are in really big trouble, because unless you can actually think your way out of this, turn off all these devices and spend about 2 years on your own in a forest, you can't get yourself back. So people are being separated from their selves, from their souls, in culture, by and large. Not necessarily universally. I mean, obviously there are people within that system who have ways and means of opting out of it and so on. But as a general pattern, you have to say, and when you look on the street and you see people going around in broad daylight on a beautiful day wearing face masks, rags on their faces, and you're tripping across these rags as you walk down the street, and dogs, dogs are licking them and then licking the faces of children. And the guys who are responsible for this are telling us that this is a mechanism to stop infection from spreading. Give me a break. You know, like, it's nothing to do with health. It's nothing to do with it. It's a tyranny directed at destroying the life of the human.
That's exactly what it is. And the sad thing is that they've convinced the people to do it largely to themselves. I've touched on this many times where I've said we're all in this gilded cage of our own making. Like, we can just open the door and get out. But kind of to parlay into what Huxley was saying, one of his last speeches, I think in 63 at Berkeley, I'll paraphrase. He said, the goal is to get people to love their servitude and to basically commit to being slaves on their own accord. They're not even struggling because they've got the telescreen in their pocket with their cell phone, so they can keep walking across the intersection with their slave mask on, and still get all that propaganda, like in 1984.
Yeah.
But sadly, they got the Brave New World thing down because most people are so heavily medicated on drugs, either prescription or otherwise. They've kind of got this horrible blend of 1984 and Brave New World. It's really disturbing.
The way I see it is, John, I call it, it's the Orwellian fist and the Huxley and velvet glove. You know, it's both. It's not a choice. It's both. But the astonishing thing about this is that people do actually seem to love their servitude. And that's a theme that's in Huxley and Orwell as well. And indeed, in some of all the great philosophers who've talked about this, that people, in a certain sense, enjoy servitude because it relieves them of responsibility for their own lives, which it seems like, implausible. But when you actually start to reflect on it and look at people, you realize that, they don't want, they would much prefer somebody a little bit tyrannical, or even quite a bit tyrannical, or increasingly tyrannical, to take charge of their lives rather than have to answer to some force or to themselves for how they conduct their lives. I think that's a real, real issue now that we hadn't again. And it probably is to do with the kind of a number of things, obviously the culture thing that we've described, but also in the kind of like post-religious world. You know, when religion was such a force in the world that it was really, it defined the imagination of the average human person, that person was very hard to kind of tyrannize because they always believed in something higher than any human. They believe in God, and God protected them against evil. You know, not in a straightforward way. Like the evil guys would succeed a little bit for a while, but ultimately they had a faith that God would retaliate, would strike back, and that they could hand their lives to God. So they weren't in handing their lives to God. They were avoiding handing them to another human being, to a tyrant.
Yeah,
that was the key. Therefore, to the freedom of man. And once God was removed from the equation, then freedom became too terrifying a prospect because you had to become God yourself in order to manage it, to manage your own freedom. And people prefer to be slaves than do that. I think there's something in that. It's a terrifying idea. But my God, it's certainly, if you look at the street of any town or city of the Western world in the last 9 months, you got to say there's something in it.
Wow, I never looked at it from that angle, but I think that's so spot on. I mean, here in the States, they removed God from the schools in, I believe, 1963. And my grandmother used to say, you know, that's when it all went south. That's when everything sort of began to degrade into where we are today. And good grief, she would be rolling over in her grave, I'm sure, right now, looking at what we're under, because I think that really is a key to your point. It really did begin to make humans gods, and we're not. So I think that sort of juxtaposition of godhood versus manhood has really caused people to just fall into that slave role.
That's right. Well, the Russian dissident Alexander Solzhenitsyn made a speech, I think, in London back in the 60s about, and he's talking, it became a famous speech where he said, I'm paraphrasing him now, but this is roughly what he said. He said that, when I was a child, and he was born in, I think, 2018, which is the year after the Russian Revolution, after the Bolshevik Revolution. So he grew up with all this stuff. And he said, when I was a child, I used to hear the old people say, man has forgotten about God. That's why these terrible things have happened in our country. And he said, I hadn't a clue what they were talking about. You know, and I can kind of identify with that, you know, that sense of the old people, you know, with their rosary beads, praying. And, you know, what do you mean, God? You know that idea when you're a kid and you're growing up, you think, oh, you've no time for that stuff. And he got that across. And then he said, you know, and he was now, I think, in his 70s when he gave the speech. And he said, you know, I've written 10 books about my country and its troubles. And I've read hundreds of other books about my country and its troubles. And I've talked to countless of my fellow countrymen about what happened. And after all that, he said, I cannot improve on what those old people said.
man has forgotten about God, and that is why these terrible things have happened in our country. And you know, when you see it exactly as we're setting it up here, you know, it's not a sentimental idea. It's not a pious idea. It's not a kind of a crawl-thumping idea. It's the idea that, just as you said, that the alternative to honoring God is to honor another human. C.S. Lewis talked about this. He said that when you eliminate God, his place is never taken by all humans. His place is taken by a few humans who tyrannize the rest. And that's what we're trying to avoid. And then like every constitution in the world is directed at avoiding that. That's the purpose of the constitution, the American constitution, the Irish constitution. The Irish constitution starts off like that. In the name of the most holy Trinity, in whom is all authority, and to whom, as our final end, all matters of men and of states must be referred. So you can imagine that all the rights that are in the constitution are raised up. They're raised up to be left at the feet of the Holy Trinity, to protect them from being plundered by tyrants. And this is the thing we missed in all of this idea to modernize and to progressivize, that we thought this old-fashioned idea of God. We forgot that, I'm an alcoholic. I've been off drink for 30 years. And I learned a lot of stuff in AA, because it's based on the God idea. God is central. And there was a book in the early days of AA, which is now probably 80 years ago, I think it was late 30s it started, by a German guy. I forget his name now, but the name of the book is really a stunning name. It's Not God. Not God. And his point was that the whole point of the AA program was to convince people, because, you know, belief in God is kind of, it's not optional. I mean, they all say to you, do you have to believe in God as you understand God? Okay? But it doesn't have to be my God or anybody's God. It's just that, and the point that this guy wrote, he says, not God. The most important thing is to understand that you are not God. And that's actually more important than believing in God, even. Because the greatest danger to man is when man starts to believe that he is God. That's when all the trouble starts. And that's what Solzhenitsyn was talking about as well. And we've forgotten that now, because our cultures have become stupefied. It is true, you know. I think that the human race, not just individually, but collectively, has become stupider in the last, I would say, 20 years. Certainly since the internet, I think you can see a real collapse in general intelligence. I don't mean, you know, the spelling and all that, mathematics, the mental arithmetic, that's true as well, but that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the kind of common sense that our grandparents took for granted. They just understood things because they had entered the world in a way that was governed by the senses. They touched things, they listened, they smelled, they saw, they felt. And now everything, knowledge is all received at a distance. It's all kind of abstract. Like we receive it, education is all out of books or out of, computer programs or something like that. And there's no way of testing or verifying everything for young people. So they're just memory banks. They just store information which they have never internalized, because there's no experience to connect it to. But they still seem to know a lot. They remember a lot, or they have recall of a lot of information. But there's no context for it. So there is meaningless to them. And they're completely, therefore, as a result, relativized human beings in terms of ethics and morality and all these things. And that's where you get all this bullshit stuff, the political correct stuff and the cultural Marxist stuff and, you know, all that kind of woke culture thing, which is all kind of pseudo-principles and kind of faux emotionalism and no real basis for it. It's not based in true compassion or true decency or true justice. Social justice warrior means the opposite of social justice. You know, it's the direct opposite. So that's kind of I think where we are with a lot of this stuff.
And I kind of think that's by design as well. I hate to keep saying that again, but I got a bunch of books behind me. I got an old set of encyclopedias, and I've often wondered if it's sort of that notion of the journey is the destination. you know, just that act of looking up a word, just that act of, let me see what this is. Let me dig through some books and tactile, like put those fingers to page and look up this stuff. I think that really is a lot of it. I remember when I was in school long ago, they would say, okay, well, we're going to teach you arithmetic and you can check it with the calculator. And now the checking it with the calculator is all people do, both in mathematics, but as well as just that old-fashioned research of getting in there with those dusty old books and looking through and trying to find what you want, because in doing so, you're going to find probably 10 other things that you didn't even know about. Instead, you just punch in, you know, dogs on the internet search engine. It'll give you everything about dogs you could ever want to know, but I think you're missing that mental exercise of actually going in there and doing it.
That's spot on, I think, John. I mean, I always, when I write an article, I always try and stick in a word or two that are just kind of out of reach of the reader that they maybe won't know. And that's not just me being smartass. You know, that's, I'm trying to go back to when I was a child learning to read, where, you know, when I would come across a word, which would happen all the time when you're a kid, learn that you don't understand. You try to figure out from the context roughly what it means, right? And then I would usually read it when I was in bed and at night or whatever, and I'd memorize the word, and the next morning I would go down and look it up in my father's dictionary, you know? And that was how I learned these words. And exactly as you say, you know, that's how we learn everything in a way. I mean, if you look at a child playing on the mat and with objects, he or she, they're playing with, they're touching things, they're feeling things. And that's that's not a small thing. That's a big thing. They're actually literally, metaphorically and otherwise, touching the world to see how it's made. And that process goes on right through their childhood and into adulthood. And the problem is, I think, that at a certain point now, much too early, it becomes abstract. We put them in front of a computer screen. And we just say, okay, the world's out there. This thing will tell you what the world is, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't go searching anymore in the world to find out what it is, to reason it out and to memorize it and to figure it out for themselves. There's some amazing stuff. There's an American guy, I think he's Colorado or somewhere, Matthew B. Crawford, and he's written some amazing books about this kind of thing. He wrote a book called Shop Class as Soulcraft. He's a motorcycle mechanic and a philosopher, which is an amazing combination. And I've written about him a lot in my last book, Give Us Back the Bad Roads. I write about it. I compare him to my father, who was like, wasn't a philosopher in this conventional sense, but he was, you know, somebody who had a huge intelligence, but he was also really good with his hands. And I think that one of the things we've lost really radically in the world is the capacity to actually use our senses to comprehend reality. And we're no longer using all our senses. We're only using a little bit of our sensual capacity in exploring the world. And what we need to do is actually reintegrate, I think, abstract knowledge with concrete knowledge. And in a way, when you actually look at the divide in the world now, as you can see in America, Trump, Biden, you can see that clearly divide in terms of the following, the people behind them. It's about this, that Trump represents the concrete people, the muscular people, the able, the Greeks used to call them the able men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, you have these kind of like tippy-tappy guys, you know, who are kind of all kind of into social media and they're into high finance and all stuff that is actually abstract. It isn't actually concrete. And I often say to people, you know, if you were to draw a line down the middle of America and divide those two tribes, and put one on one side of the line, the other side, right? And leave them there for a year. In a year, all the people on one side would be dead from starvation. And the other would have rebuilt American civilization from the ground up in a year. Because they can use their hands to do it. And that is a form of intelligence. I mean, Crawford talks about that as intelligence. Like, there's a brilliant sequence in one of his books, another book called The World Outside My Head. And I think it's in this book that actually this particular thing happened, where he's describing, you know, like a motorcycle race. And there's a classic picture you see from that, which is like the motorcycle on the rider is coming around a curve on a hill, and his bike is almost like his elbow is touching the tarmac, you know, because he's kind of, you know. And what Crawford does, he sort of freeze frames that, and he translates into these two kind of stretches of rubber, like maybe a few inches of rubber are contacting the road, right? And through these stretches, there's a vibration coming from the road through the frame of the bike, through the arms and legs of the rider. And out of this, he can manage to actually keep the bike on the road at the maximum speed in order to achieve it. He says, this is a phenomenal level of intelligence that we have completely discounted in our culture. And I think he's so right, because we don't respect that understanding of intelligence anymore. We see that as some kind of random kind of, I don't know, brainless activity. Interesting to watch, exciting in a way, but not intelligence. But it is intelligence. That's what it is. And that was the intelligence that made the world, that allowed the world to be built as it is in our civilization. And now we kind of think that you can actually have a civilization based on Twitter. You know, I mean, Twitter. I often say to people, you know, that if there is a future, and if there are anthropologists in that future to deal with a project, which would be something like, what happened to Western civilization in the first decades of the 21st century? How come it completely fell off the cliff? If there's some those guys. So they will go into the, you know, problem for weeks and months. And in the end, they will come out with an answer on a piece of paper, right? What happened to Western civilization? And there will be one word. The answer will be one word. And that word will be Twitter. Because nothing is as destructive to our civilization as Twitter is. Because it is a meaningless exchange of stupid ideas most of the time.
That's exactly it. They kicked me off of there about a year and a half ago, so I'm not on there at all. But I love what you just said there about the guy on the bike, on the motorcycle, rather, taking that turn, because I think that's really emblematic of that sort of ebb and flow, that perfect equilibrium that we need to have with nature. And I'm not suggesting that we go hippie and go live in a tree or anything, but I think if you look at that first decade of the 2000s here, that's kind of one of those big problems. We've become so disconnected, not only with our fellow humans, but with our world around us. We're locked in that cubicle, we're locked in that house, we're looking at the telescreens, whether it's our phone, our TV, or our device. And we've just lost that equilibrium, that connection to God, that connection to nature. That's pretty much been severed. And I hate to say, but it's been willingly severed. The slaves have just sort of capitulated and said, okay, well, this is what we're going to do now. It's just like the mask thing.
Yeah, you see, and it's interesting, you know, when even though we've been having this conversation, and though we're exchanging the same ideas and we're talking, but when you say then, you mentioned the God thing there. And some kind of, you know, this is interesting. Some kind of alarm went off in my mind at the mention of the God, the G word, you know, because you're not permitted. And we forbid ourselves to talk in these terms. But that's missing something, because that's implying that there's a kind of an irrational residue in our culture that we should still subscribe to. That's kind of what that prejudice is. But actually, there's an entirely different way of seeing this that people need to understand. And I put it something like this, that all of us, no matter how much we think we know and how much we think we know ourselves, there's a whole thing about ourselves that we actually don't know and can never know. And that is where we come from. And what force it was, if any, ordained that we'd be here. And if there is a purpose, that's what that purpose is. And where we are going then after. And whether we like it or not, no matter what we call ourselves, Christians, Buddhists, atheists, whatever, agnostics, doesn't matter. Those questions accompany us every moment, waking or sleeping. They inform our very psyche. Those questions, we are walking question marks. Because we don't know the greater things about ourselves. And for that reason, your imagination, the imagination of a human person, which does not have a space for at least tentatively or provisionally dealing with those questions is not capable of informing that person sufficiently to equip them for the journey they're on. No matter what you call yourself, no matter how you describe it, language is slippery. Language is kind of, you know, a bit of a problem in this regard because you kind of set off all kinds of tripwires. But this is fundamental to the human journey, that we are defined by these mysteries. And if you don't have a space for accommodating them in some way, and you see, the thing is, you can accommodate them in a simplistic way or in a complex way. And it doesn't really matter so long as you do accommodate them. You often find, you know, that the simplest, most simplistic religious mentality is actually much more effective at dealing with reality than a secular and atheist mentality. But you can have a highly sophisticated religious mentality. You can overcomplicate it, obviously, too. I learned this in AA, too. But it's, the point is that you absolutely do need that religion at this level, and this is something religious people misunderstand when I say it, but it's important to see it. Religion fundamentally is about the human imagination, about the possibility that exists for the human person, that you allow for as much possibility as remotely possible. And unless you can do that, you're not able to stand up full straight in reality. You're bowed down. And more what's happened in our culture now is we're going down, like we're like hunchbacked, as though the ceiling has started to close down on us culturally. And you can see it. I mean, that literally becomes true when you see the whole social media thing, which started off as a big explosion of supposed democratic free speech. And now it's become the direct opposite. It is a tyranny of censorship. You know, that the human, again, it's that thing. Once humans start to become God, once you decide God doesn't exist, so I'll become God, or they act like God, that's the beginning of the end, always. And that's what you can see in the demeanor of politicians and health czars and these experts now. It's this appetite suddenly to inhabit, to occupy the throne of God. That God, whatever that word means to you or anybody, it means 7 billion different things. But once you decide that you are going to be the person who is not man, not woman, not human, but a little bit better, then that's the beginning of the end for everybody.
Wow, that is beautiful. That's true. And I can't help but think of the Plato's allegory of the cave while you're talking about all this, because I think they've collectively put us all in the cave, and they're the ones flashing the shadows on the wall of whatever they want us to see.
Yes.
And I know the censorship is a huge thing here in the States, but as well in Ireland. And before we go, I definitely got to touch on that. How does that play out as far as folks like yourself and others that are just trying to get the word out about basic knowledge? I know you had a court appeal, I believe, last week.
Yeah,
and there's just all kinds of insanity going on over there with the COVID scam and just trying to walk around without a mask and businesses being shut down. I mean, I can only believe that it's pretty similar to what's going on here, but I'm not over there. So,
well, it is very similar, I think, you know, in a lot of very meaningful and, in fact, pretty much all the meaningful ways. Ireland is now the 51st state of America in lots and lots of ways. That, you know, and that could be a great thing, but it actually isn't. It's all the bad things in a way. I mean, you know, the economy of Ireland, because of the particular choices that were made by politicians here for the last 50 years, is based on foreign direct investment. I mean, they basically gave up on trying to create an indigenous self-sufficient economy, and they decided basically that, you know, the way I put it is like, well, you know, my grandfather died and left me a shop on the high street, and there was a flat, an apartment overhead, and I sat around thinking, well, what am I going to sell in this shop? And then I came up with a brilliant idea. Why don't I just rent out this shop and live overhead? And that's what we're doing. That's what we've done in Ireland. So our big tenant is Big Pharma, and so you can imagine what kind of dynamics that creates in a situation like the COVID situation, you know, where we're basically like something like, I think 60-odd% of our GDP is pharmaceuticals.
Wow. Like,
crazy. It's completely bonkers. And the rest is kind of big tech and stuff. I mean, the Irish, and then meanwhile, they're collapsing the actual real, what is left of the real Irish economy. The small businesses, the cafes, the pubs, the shops, all that's been destroyed in this. And yet, the irony is that our figures show, well, we're doing really well. And the journalists actually repeat this, as if they don't know that big pharma is the reason. You know, like, it's insane. It's beyond insane. So I've been saying this for years. I wrote a book, as I say, Give Us Back the Bad Roads, back about 2 years ago. And it's about the referendums that happened here. And this is a continuation of all that. Where we're essentially, Ireland is essentially a petri dish for a lot of experimentation now on human race, on the human race, particularly religious people who were recently deeply religious or appear to be, right? Mm-hmm. And Ireland was intensely appeared to be Christian Catholic up to relatively recently. And it's like as if the experiment is an almost a diabolical attempt to see how quickly can you get people to jettison all this stuff, you know, if you really go about it in the right way. And that's what they've been doing. And so, like, we've been taken over by LGBT, who just basically strut around the place, you know, destroying people's reputations, destroying people's livelihoods, you know, spitting in people's faces almost literally. We've had abortionists. We have, you know, we have diabolical leaders, like, who have sold out every principle they ever espoused at an earlier stage in their career. We have people now on TV, leaders like menacing people, you know, as I say, like speaking like Adolf Eichmann would speak about the transportation of Jews to Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen. This is what we've got. We've got a complete moral inversion in Ireland, where now good is bad and bad is good. This is really hard for people outside. In America particularly, with a lot of affection for Ireland in America. And I have really, really serious trouble persuading people how bad things have got. But the COVID thing, we've decided, we have a really strong constitution, like America. One of the great things we inherited, the good things we inherited from our relationship, our long and terrible relationship with England, was, you know, a common law tradition. And common law is a really beautiful thing because it's based on the idea that each man is free and that the state only exists to facilitate that freedom. Now, that's quite different to a lot of, Napoleonic tradition in Europe, whereby the state has the power and dispenses it, more or less. But the principle of common law is like, you know, that the people may do whatever they please except that which they expressly forbid. And the state may do nothing except what the people permit. And that has been now flipped over in this whole thing, where the state are now, they have adopted essentially the Napoleonic code without telling anybody or explaining how they were entitled to do this. And so this has been a continuation of a decades-long war on the Constitution of Ireland. And that's why myself and Jim O'Doherty have gone to court to defend the Constitution and to ask, you know, what does the Constitution represent? Or was it all the time? Did we not know? Did we miss that all the time we thought this was a charter of freedom, that it was actually a charter for tyranny all the time, that it permits this? And what we've been trying to do is get a court to comment on this, to make a judgment, a ruling on this, because it's a really simple question. But the courts have ducked and dived and tried to kind of, you know, they lied about us and they tried to terrify us with the bill of costs and all this kind of stuff. But we've kept coming and we're still coming. And we have to finish this, John. You know, we just have to get the answer one way or other, yes or no. Is the Constitution real or is it not real? Because then we know. But they've been ducking and diving, trying to dodge the question. And that's what we're trying to do now. Because, you see, that's what happens when a country that is completely compromised. All this has to do with the history of Ireland, which is based in the colonial past, you know. And this happens, right? This happened all over Africa. Probably more extreme in Africa for all kinds of reasons. But in Ireland, it's just as bad, except it's maybe a little bit more subtle. And because we appear to be ostensibly the same color as our, or the same appearance vaguely as our oppressors, you know, there's no real sense of distinction. But what happens in a post-colonial society is that, you know, unless they have a project of national realization and of casting off the colonial legacy in a very explicit way, what actually happens is that you end up with a corrupt leadership who essentially break up the country for scrap and sell it off. You know, they sell off concessions to outsiders. Well, what I've just said to you about Big Pharma and all that, I mean, is exactly what happens. I mean, when the chemical industries started to come, the transnational corporations started to come to Ireland back in the 70s, they were actually promised, they were told, look, Ireland's got a pristine environment, a landscape, so you can pollute as long as you like and nobody will notice.
Jeez.
Like they literally said that they called it the natural endowment factor or the absorption capacity of the Irish landscape. They sold the absorption capacity of the Irish landscape as a resource to American chemical companies to come here because they were running away from environmental laws in America that were just beginning to sprout up over there because it was a realization that this was really getting quite serious. And the ironic thing about it, John, is that all this has happened was the responsibility of people who are now preaching to us about climate change and threatening us that if we don't stop putting, we don't start putting our plastic in the correct colored bin, we would be regarded as criminals and maybe even end up in one of their detention centers, which they're setting up for the COVID tyranny. It's beyond belief, John. I mean, the most important thing that I can say out of my mouth, with the words that come out of my mouth here to you now, is to say this sentence. There are no words for describing this moment in our history. Because we grew up reading Orwell, particularly Orwell, in our teenage years. And you know, we had a kind of a condescending attitude, I think, to the idea, even though we thought they were astonishing books and scary in their way. But they seem to be about a different kind of world to the one we inhabited. They were things that happened at a distance and in the past. It never occurred to us that they might occur in the future here. That was like, we would have laughed at that idea. Implicitly, we were laughing at that idea. But now it's here. And most of us can't recognize that it's here. Like, there are people writing for newspapers who have read Orwell and they don't realize that the words they're writing are straight out of 1984. Every day.
Yeah, they are Pravda. They are the Ministry of Truth, rather.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a great thing. I'm, like, in a certain sense, we're tongue-tied in the face of this. You know, I'm still reading about it. I'm reading about a word I only came across in the last couple of weeks, tonerology, which is the study of evil in biological terms. Really amazing idea, but it exists and was studied in Poland back in the time of, you know, in 50 years ago. And there are books about it. But this is something, you know, we have had a recreational culture in the West for 50, 60 years. Since the war, it's been recreational. Everything about our culture is recreational. If you go to Eastern Europe, where they have had real tyranny in their faces, it's not recreational. Their literature is not recreational. It's real. And this is something we've lost. I mean, I was speaking in Notre Dame, where I was, again, not in Notre Dame, but I was actually on a webinar, on a Zoom line to a conference in Notre Dame. And I was talking about this idea, that actually, we're talking about literature, that there has been a total failure of prophecy in the literature of the West in recent times. Like, you have to go back to Orwell to get any sense of a prediction of all of this. Like, the rest is like whisting past the graveyard. Like, you know, it's nothing. There's nothing there. Even in the greatest of our novelists, there's nothing there to say. And how then can a novelist be regarded as a great artist when he or she failed to understand what he or she was standing on, what was actually rumbling already under his or her feet? You know,
that's true.
There's nothing to tell people that this could happen in our societies, other than Orwell and Huxley. And they're interesting in the sense that I think, I don't know so much about Orwell had a lot of dodgy kind of connections. About he was involved in the MI5 and the civil service and all that. He knew his way around all that stuff. Huxley's brother was a scientist and was one of the founders of UNESCO. So he knew all about this stuff firsthand. So, like, but since then, there's been, although you have to go into to sci-fi to find it. And, of course, nobody really took that seriously. You have to read someone like Philip K. Dick or those kind of guys who were creating these scenarios. But they were kind of, again, recreational, it seemed. They weren't real warnings. They were not prophecies in the sense that they weren't designed or capable of being seen as real. And so we're lost now for words to describe how this could be happening to us. And again, this is going back to the very place we started. That's even more confounded when you see a figure like Trump, who is the guy on the fight. He's the Lone Ranger, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And he doesn't seem to understand. He's wearing a mask. Okay, he's wearing it on his eyes, not on his face. And he stopped wearing it on his face. And that's good. But he doesn't seem to quite get it. Whether he's just pretending not to get it or not, as we said, remains to be seen. Let's hope we haven't seen the end of that story. Because in a way, you know, this is the irony of it now, that the place that was once taken by literature is taken by reality. Reality is now so far ahead of the capacity of literature to imagine it that we just watch. We just watch and see what happens. We can't read it anywhere.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes if it's just because people have forgotten all that science fiction. I'm a sucker for all the 70s era science fiction movies. And
yeah.
They're so telling because they've all just about come true. I mean, we may not be on a space station fiddling with all this stuff, but we're instead here on Earth dealing with that same sort of tyranny. I wonder sometimes if that's the disconnect between people, but I don't know.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, like, you know, when we go back to school, when we were kids in school, like there was always the kind of a stock essay that people would, that you would get asked to write in the exams, life in 2018, you know, and like the thing about it is all the things we kind of thought were going to happen, like that we wouldn't have any food. We just have pills. We just drop a pill and that would be your dinner, things like that, or flying cars or whatever it was. Like reality never turns out to be like that kind of prophecy. Predicts it always is much more like continuous, or it's much less futuristic when it actually becomes the future than you thought it was going to be. It's kind of thing. And yet in other ways it changes radically in ways that nobody is able to anticipate. I have an interesting kind of I used to write plays, and one of my first play was actually written over about 27-28 years ago. And it was set in a kind of apocalyptic kind of situation, a kind of nuclear war or something like that, in a house with just two figures talking. And the weird thing was that it was set in the future. It was like early 90s. It was set in the future. And the date I had in mind was 2020. And actually the irony of it is that the people are all locked into their houses. And there's like, there's no TV, but there's like a virtual reality headset, which you put on you go around, you're in Beirut or you're in, wherever it is, Beijing, and, you're seeing the tanks coming at you, whatever it is. The reason I chose that, it wasn't explicit. The date was not explicit, but it was approximately obvious. And the reason I kind of chose it was to kind of pick a moment when clearly the play was talking about a future, but not necessarily an identifiable one or not seeking to make any point. It was just like the future as a kind of like an accidental backdrop to something, to a question or series of questions. And looking at it now, I realize that it's actually, the play it was about fatherhood. And in that way, you know, the destruction of fatherhood, and that turned out to be extraordinarily prophetic in its way. That was the first hammer blow on the family, to remove the father if possible. And, you know, nearly 40% of families now in the Western world have no father. But the future, like, it's the way time evolves. It's a very strange process, and nothing like it seems real prophet. I don't believe, for example, that Orwell and Huxley were prophets. They knew what was going to happen. They were told what was going to happen. Mostly.
Yeah.
So it's a different thing. It wasn't an imaginative exercise. Like, in a way, the way that Orwell wrote that book, like, it's an amazing, when you read about how he wrote it on his deathbed. You know, he was dying of tuberculosis, and he literally wrote the book on it, and he wrote it against the clock of his own life. He wrote it against the ebbing of his own life. And it was like, it was all there. He just churned it out, page after page after page, day after day after day, and he finished it just in time, pretty much. And you know, this is a thing, I think, a huge failure in our culture, that we're actually, for all that we, you know, talk about progress, we don't seem to understand the meaning of the word, because the more we try to progress, the more we actually go backwards in our capacity to be human, in our moral development, in all kinds of ways, and in our intelligence, as we said. So I don't know. I think, you know, how do you get around that? How do you foresee, as it were, any kind of capacity in the human race to rectify any of that? I honestly can't be hopeful about that. Obviously, I am hopeful in some kind of way that I hope is not sentimental. I do believe in the capacity of the human spirit to renew itself when things get really tough. But it takes a hell of a lot to bring the human race collectively to that pitch, that point. And we're not there yet. But I think we're moving inexorably closer to that point. And you know, whether we're going to make it before the World Bank reaches its deadline in March 2025 remains to be seen.
Wow. Well, I know you got to go in a second, but I was going to ask you one more thing before you go, if you have a moment.
Sure.
I hate to say, where do you think all this is going? But I guess I'll spin it around a little bit. And from my perspective, what I'm seeing with the people in Europe, and even a little bit of Asia, I have to say, is that the people are rising up against this tyranny way more than what I'm seeing in America. And I'm not suggesting everybody go do violence or anything like that, but I am just saying, I don't know if it's because of the close proximity in time or absolute location to the folks in Europe, to what was going on with communism and what was going on with Russia and Ukraine or what, but that's sort of my anger here in the States is where's that righteous indignation? Where's the people out in the streets with their umbrellas or with their yellow shirts or what have you? Where's that indignation? I just don't see it. What's your take on that before you go?
You put a very interesting kind of thought into my head, John, with that, you know, because now in general, I don't totally go with you because I've seen a lot of good spirited stuff coming out of America in the last 6 months in different places, you know, different states. I can't remember which ones, but there were, you know, in the summer, there was a bit of spirited stuff, you know, and against governors and so on. But in general, I understand what you're saying. And it's interesting you say that. And I kind of, in a certain sense, made a comparison there earlier between the Napoleonic tradition, legal tradition, and the common law traditions, and unfavorably against the Napoleonic tradition. And I wonder, actually, if the problem is not something like that we in the common law jurisdictions take for granted our freedoms. We just assume that they're going to be protected because they're natural. Whereas those people in Europe, you know, they've always had to fight tyrannies of some one kind or another, whether it was, you know, in Spain, Franco, or, you know, in Stalin or whatever the tyrant was. And we kind of had been, to an extent, saved from tyranny within our own jurisdictions by and large. In America, in Australia, in New Zealand, in Britain and Ireland. Apart from that, well, I weave it a different history, but in this sense, certainly in recent times, for the past century, you had a pretty peaceful time. And I just wonder if it's that we don't really understand how close tyranny is to it all the time, and that we get say, oh, it'll pass, you know. And I think that they know it doesn't pass. They know it stops and it gets dug in for a hell of a long time, like 40 years of communism, you know,
mm-hmm.
Eastern Europe, you know. I remember once having a conversation I was in Prague in 1990 for the first elections after the Velvet Revolution. And there was a man there that I met on the morning of the camp in the Palace of Culture, it was called, in Vysharad. And Gareth Fitzgerald, he was a former Taoiseach, former Prime Minister of Ireland. And I was talking to him on that morning, and I was really excited because I'd seen Havel. I'd been watching Havel for years, and I'd seen him in the recent days. And it was such an intoxicating moment. And I said to Gareth Fitzgerald, I said, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a moment like this back home? And he says, yes, but it's not worth 40 years of communism. Well, we might be now just about to find out what that's like. It's like we're sleepwalking into it. It seems like everything we learned is gone, erased. All that's just the Orwell, all the Huxley, all the history. Everything's gone from our consciousness. But I do have hope for America, and I think that it's to do with that fundamental fault of the earth, the able man. There are a lot of able men in America yet, and they're real men, you know? And I place my trust and hope in them. With or without Trump, they are, you know, the way they have been awakened by Donald Trump. Because they were quite, I won't say depressed, but they were, you know, disenchanted. They didn't believe in themselves anymore. Now they do. And I think that this, you know, this what's happening in America, I think, has to come to some kind of denouement in which those forces, good and evil, and that's what it is, will finally clash. And ultimately, we know that good must triumph in the end. That's not a pious aspiration. That's a physical reality. The world cannot prosper, cannot survive unless good prospers, ultimately. And so I have faith in that. But it's going to be a journey of, you know, great grief and pain and fear and all that. All the bad stuff is going to happen. But in the end, I think the world will come right. And I think America has a central role to play in it now because of Donald Trump's mission to awaken the sleeping giant of, you know, the working American person, a working American. And those people are not going to go back into their shells again.
That's beautiful. Well, I certainly hope so. What's the best place everybody can follow what you're doing and check out your work and just stay up to date on what you're doing?
Well, I have this John Waters Unchained. You can I call it after the Johnny Cash song, Unchained. So you get me there. It's on Substack, but I don't know what Substack means. It's a platform, you know. But John Waters Unchained will find it on DuckDuckGo, not Google. Don't Google me ever. Don't Wikipedia me ever. Don't ask any of the big tech people about me. They will tell you lies. DuckDuckGo, John Waters Unchained, one T, WATERS. And don't mix me up with the guy who makes the dirty films at anything. And also you get me on, I do a lot of talks with Gemma, GemmaOdoherty.com. She's my partner in public work. She's in my partner in this challenge to the lockdown in the courts, which we're now working our way through. And so she's got a website. She does amazing talks herself online, jimodarty.com. Truly inspirational figure. So that's kind of it, really. We're just two people who are trying to, you know, with a little help from people around us, to save our country and, I suppose, by extension, join the forces that are trying to save the world and take it back from the brink of the diabolical.
Well, that sounds great. Well, if you'll stick around for about 10 seconds, I'll wrap things up and say goodbye to you off the air here.
Okay, John.
All right, thank you. Wow, that was an awesome conversation, to say the least, folks. If you missed any of that, please check it out at anomicage.com. You can find the video and the audio from today's guests and all the past guests and so much more, anomicage.com. As always, close with, you can't do everything, but you can do something. So please try to get out there and make a difference and do your parts. Until next time, be safe out there, and I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm gonna go get some more.